This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. In the earliest days of the Republic, people lived mostly along the Atlantic coast. A short journey westward puts you in the hinterlands. George Washington feared that Americans beyond the Alleghenies would disengage from their coastal compatriots and seek independence. New Yorkers eyed the distant shores of Lake Erie and dreamt of becoming the port that would connect America's potentially rich interior to commerce on the high seas. Both Washington and New Yorker DeWitt Clinton dreamt of canals, one along the Potomac, the other due west from the upper reaches of the Hudson. It was Clinton and New York whose vision prevailed, and Americans still learned to sing of that triumph of technology and imagination in the 1820s.
I got a mule and her name is Sal. 15 miles on the Erie Canal. She's a good old worker and a good old pal. 15 miles on the Erie Canal.
Peter Bernstein has written about the building of the canal from Albany to Buffalo in Wedding of the Waters, the Erie Canal, and the Making of a Great Nation. Peter Bernstein, first, tell us just the scope of this thing.
The scope, by any standard of measurement, or any comparison to other canals, like the Panama Canal, I think is 40 miles, and the Suez Canal is somewhat longer than that. This is 383 miles from Albany to Buffalo. Buffalo is 550 feet above Albany, so that the canal had to climb that high. But there was much more than that because there are undulations in between. There's over 700 feet of up and down or having to build locks to lift and lower boats on their travels. Mm-hmm. And then the huge job at the western end of scaling the escarpment that Niagara Falls falls over about 20 miles away. The engineering achievement was really mind-boggling.
And for most of that length, if not all of it, we're talking about a fairly narrow, about 40 foot wide, right? And
the canal is 24 feet wide and 4 feet deep. The boats on the canal were all pulled by animals because the canal was too shallow for motorboats. Among the other spectacular features of this project was that most of it, almost all of it, was hacked through dense forest that had been there for thousands and thousands of years. So the trees had to be cut down, the stumps had to be pulled out of the ground. It was a daunting task, and that was something that no other canal that I'm ever aware of anywhere in the world had to confront.
The individual, I guess, most associated with building the Erie Canal was DeWitt Clinton. Tell us about DeWitt Clinton.
DeWitt Clinton, he's a great hero. I mean, when I began the story, I didn't know all that much about him, but I fell in love with him as it went on. He was a serious scientist and ornithologist, fantastically fluent and eloquent speaker, with a powerful political urge. He was in the U.S. Senate, and then he was mayor of New York, which was then an appointed position, and later governor several times around. In these roles, he was important in passing laws for the manumission of slaves. This meant that slaves that escaped to the North would be free men. Very instrumental in starting free schooling in New York City for the poor so that they would be educated. It's a very important person, quite aside from his pioneering, really dogged leadership on the issue of the Erie Canal, which had a lot of opposition for many years before it finally got going.
There are cities and towns in New York State that were just given enormous economic life by the development of the Erie Canal.
Yes. I mean, when you read the changes in population and the growth in the number of factories and the number of patents that were issued to people along the Erie Canal in the first 10, 15 years. But I think even more important than that, because this opened the link, brought the oceans into the interior, and the interior was able to reach the oceans, the development of the West was changed in a revolutionary way. You think of the line of Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, that developed much faster than it ever would have, if it would have at all. The focus of the country was changed from north-south to east-west. Even after the railroads were opened, the Erie Canal was carrying more freight than the railroads. And indeed today, the telephone lines, the internet lines, everything still goes through that gorge at Little Falls. It's a major link between the Atlantic states and the West.
In the epilogue to your book, you pose the hypothetical problem that if we were around sometime around the very beginning of the 19th century, end of the 18th century, with two competing ideas for how to build a canal, one Washington and Virginia and private capital, and the other New York and a bunch of people we've never heard of, and the government behind it, we would all back Virginia. That's the 21st century idea of what a successful project would be.
Yes, indeed. I thought about this all the time that I was writing the book, that the contrast was so amazing and the difference in the results was so amazing. Washington did a small IPO. He sold shares to friends. He was hard to turn down. And yet his project really, it went bankrupt. The Erie Canal, on the other hand, was managed by a commission of politicians of opposing parties. It was all publicly financed. Everything went through on time. Everything worked without a glitch. The cost overruns were negligible. And yes, if you had to guess ahead of time which one you would pick, you certainly would have picked Washington.
Peter Bernstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Bernstein is the author of Wedding of the Waters, The Erie Canal, and the Making of a Great Nation.